So much talk over the past many months of borders and walls and roundups. We don't seem quite ready as a nation to move to a higher level of discourse. Or perhaps that's actually what we are in the midst of. Today, we look at California's borders, the immigrants traveling over our southern border, rolling in on bicycles, and the furry, four-footed immigrants, tagged and collared, reclaiming their territory on our northern border. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Kimball Taylor is a journalist whose curiosity reveals a story that sometimes reads like a bizarre work of fiction. The Coyote's Bicycle, the untold story of 7,000 bicycles and the rise of a borderland empire, follows trails leading from San Diego, Tijuana, and across the country's military complexes. Taylor unearths incredible stories of human migration across our southern border and the bicycles that travel even further. Later in the broadcast, we look at a different sort of migration when we talk with Emma Bland Smith on her book that portrays the story of OR7, who came to be known as Journey, the first gray wolf to return to California in nearly 100 years. So please stay with us. The bicycle is often our first mode of transportation and independence, and sometimes it's the first real possession we have, and as often, it's the first possession that we lose to theft. When journalist Kimball Taylor encountered piles of abandoned bikes at the Tijuana border, he embarked on an investigation not only into how these bikes were being used to transport migrants into this country, but into the people involved in the movement and the economy that supported a cast of characters on both sides of the border. The story ranges around over time and geography as pieces of the story reveal themselves to him. Kimball Taylor is the author of Return by Water, Surf Stories and Adventures, and Drive Fast and Take Chances, Fair Warning from Surfers. I had the pleasure of speaking with him the other day from his home in San Diego, California. Kimball Taylor, before we begin talking about your book, The Coyote's Bicycle, the untold story of 7,000 bicycles and the rise of a borderland empire, I can't let our national election go without having you comment on that. Especially because a lot of what Donald Trump was peddling in his campaign was a big border wall. And I think you have a recent op-ed piece on that. But tell me what your reactions to the election have been.
Well, I would start by saying that my book is not an academic book about borders. It's a narrative about a specific coyote and a very dramatic rags-to-riches story. But that said, during my research for this book, I spent a good 4 or 5 years getting to know our boundary intimately, not just the area, but the actual physical structures, the walls, and the history of wall building in this country. And the first thing I would want readers to know is just the scale of what we're talking about. Our boundary is a third of the circumference of the moon. It's comprised of surging mountains and plummeting canyons and wilderness area. So just the feat of building a wall is one thing. The other thing is maintaining it. I made an analogy in an op-ed piece for the LA Times that it's somewhat like the painting of the Golden Gate Bridge, which is end to end, year after year after year. And that's what maintaining this boundary would be like. Another thing I would want people to know is that we've had negative migration numbers since 2008. So for 10 years now, we've had more people leaving the United States and returning to their home countries then are entering illegally. And studies suggest that people migrate in a certain age bracket, say from your late teens to your early 30s. When we were having our housing boom and we had a lot of migration, Mexico was also undergoing a youth boom. So people were in that age bracket and ready to migrate to take those jobs. But since then, that youth boom has aged out of that bracket. So not only have we had negative migration numbers, it looks like we're not going to have any kind of surge anytime soon. So when we talk about spending billions of dollars to create this unprecedented edifice, I think what we're looking at is the resources that would normally go into our schools, into our infrastructure, into our bridges, our highways, and our economy, just being spilled on the desert floor.
And it might call for many of us to become activists where we didn't think we would need to be doing this at this point in time. Thanks for that. And I think before we get deep into the book, some of our listeners might not be familiar with your previous work, and I found it kind of interesting as well that your previous writing has been all about surfing and the surf culture. And how did you get into that? And then how did that lead into this book? And it seems like this book was really driven by your own personal curiosity.
I normally write about ocean issues as well as action sports. And the interesting thing about that, even though the surfer has this reputation for being shallow, hedonistic, the ocean unites all of us. And so in my work, I've covered the disaster at Fukushima or the BP oil spill as it affects people who use the ocean. Around 2008, I got an assignment to cover the phenomenon of thousands of car tires that cross in the Tijuana River from Mexico into the United States during any significant rain. And the thing that was interesting about that is all of those car tires that were so reliably spilling across the border actually came from California and other Western states before entering Mexico, because we pay a fee to have our used tires disposed of. But what really happens is they're sold to middlemen who take those used tires to Mexico. And after they're used, they're dumped in the watershed somewhere. And when it rains, they float right back to the U.S. for free. I was down in the Tijuana River Valley, which is just on the other side of the border from Mexico. And it's a very interesting area because it's quite rural. There's horse ranches and there's organic farms and giant estuary and the ocean itself. And on either side of this valley are bubbling metropolises, Tijuana on one side and San Diego on the other. I was down there talking to this rancher about the car tires, even as he was lifting tires into a 40-foot dumpster. And we're talking about the circularity of their travels. And he said, oh, it's just like the bicycles. And I said, what are you talking about, bicycles? And he said, come here. And we walked around his barn. He had a giant pile of bicycles. He said he'd collected 1,000 bikes in the last 6 months. I asked, where are they coming from? And he turned around and he pointed up the hill, because Tijuana is actually 300 feet higher in elevation than the American Valley below. And he said, the Mexicans. Well, all along that stretch to the ocean, from the county park to the city park to these farms and ranches, people had gathered these abandoned bicycles into piles. And there's something that happens to you when you walk into a pile of bicycles. Not just me, but I saw it happen to other people as well. You see bikes from all stages of your life, and bicycles connect to your childhood. They're your first means of mobility, your first connection with freedom, and just the sensation of flying along on a bicycle. It connects deeply with people. And this pile of bicycles just lit me with questions. Where were they coming from? Where were they going? Was this crossing organized, or was it a trend? Were regular people just deciding to pick up a bicycle? And if it was organized, who was doing it? And was there a central character? The other thing I'd like to mention is that where this was happening is the most fortified 5 miles of our 2,000-mile border. Every technology that the Border Patrol can bring to bear, from laser tripwires to infrared cameras to seismic sensors, the boundaries themselves, the layers of fencing and road, as well as agents on quads and in kilo trucks and in jeeps on foot. It's just, it historically has defined our relationship between Mexico and the United States as it pertains to this boundary. And here it was every day, unseen, migrants were crossing on bicycle, dumping their bikes, and just merging into the American society.
I think this book is as much about your own curiosity as largely what made the book so compelling. And that these bikes, as you say, had a history of their own, only a part of which was their use in the transporting of people over the border. And I found that kind of odd in a way, that these bicycles then became a commodity that was making money for a lot of different people at a lot of different places. And the book weaves a lot of different stories together. And one of the stories, and I want to get to, well, maybe we should just get to it now, some of the key players in the book. And kind of one of the most mysterious players, Pablo Pablito El Indio, the quiet Oaxacan who was the person behind all this, and how you discovered about him and some of your sources and your relationship with El Negro. And so without confusing our listeners too much, maybe talk about him and how his way of watching the border kind of led to this rise of using bicycles.
Well, bicycles are incredible machines. They're not only the thing you want to steal on one hand, but they're also the means of getting away with that thing. The bicycles are fungible, like a dollar is fungible. Both bicycles and dollars have serial numbers, but there's no registry for those serial numbers. And just as once a dollar leaves your hand, it joins the idea of a dollar. And once a bicycle leaves your hand, it joins the sea of bicycles. And the only way that I could track these bikes, that these abandoned bicycles that I came upon in the Tijuana River Valley, was to talk to and investigate the people who had handed them one to the next. And after that day in 2008, when I first encountered the bicycles, I learned that the bicycles were immediately fleeing into the American society in all manner of ways. This one rancher who was collecting bicycles was selling them to a movie studio that happened to be contracting with various arms of the military to build these fake sets that were meant to replicate Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan. And they said they were bringing Hollywood magic to war training. And they were building these sets at all the most important military bases across the country. And they were stocking these sets with bicycles, because their advisors told them that bicycles were the key mode of transportation in the locations that these villages were meant to replicate. And so, on one hand, you have they're ordinary bicycles violating the sovereignty of the United States under the feet of a migrant, and suddenly they're serving our military efforts in the surge in Afghanistan. And that's just one example of how bicycles move through our society. I make this analogy that it's somewhat like the estuary at high tide. At low tide, you can barely even see the estuary, but at high tide, suddenly this liquid blue is coloring all the arteries and the smallest oxbows in this valley and alighting how the ecology works. Well, so were these bicycles. They were like ink in the plumbing. They were showing how our economy links together in surprising ways, and how different arms of authority mesh together with the criminal world. because these bicycles, they went through the black market. They served in official capacities. At one stage, however, when I felt that I had followed them as far as they could go into the United States, I realized to understand their origins, how they got to Mexico, and why they were successful as a technique in crossing this dangerous landscape, I had to go to Mexico and I had to talk to the people who were doing this. Once I started doing that, a series of coincidences put me in touch with probably the only person that could have helped me ferret out this story. Already there was a legend brewing in Tijuana about this famous coyote, the bicycle coyote named El Indio, who was quite mysterious. And to get that inner story, to get how he built that business and what was going on there, I had to make alliances with people who work in all kinds of capacities in the border economy. And that's where I met El Negro, who worked at the public bathrooms in Playas de Tijuana. He got to be an incredible investigator, a fan of a story. He was a source that turned into an ally in uncovering this story.
I want to just back up a second, because I thought that the whole military tie-in and the movie studio in San Diego and was one of the weirder kind of storylines about these bicycles. And it wasn't so much about the bicycles, but that this activity happens at all, that there's a whole economy around building essentially sets and scenarios for soldiers to prepare to go over and invade villages. I guess I never had thought about that before, but that was a surprising element to be unearthed, and that there were so many people involved as workers in that who maybe even weren't even getting paid all that well to do this bidding for the military. I mean, did you know about any of that before, or did you find it as weird as I found it reading it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why I got into it as deep as I did, because it is so strange. But, you know, I think the migrants are recreating themselves, and I think there's an analogy there, because each of it, you know, at every step of the way the bikes were undergoing transformations in terms of their duties as well. One of the more interesting images that I just found fascinating was this movie studio built a large village in the California desert that was hemmed in by mountains. And actors of all stripes, some of them were Native American, some of them were from Middle Eastern countries, and they would staff these villages as potential insurgents or just the regular people of these villages. But in the instance of this one site in the California desert, the actors actually had to live there because it was so far from anywhere else. And they used the bicycles, the same ones that had crossed the Mexican border, they used them as their transportation to go from their fake houses to the fake market. There was a fake gas station where they had a little site to repair their bicycles. Meanwhile, in the mountains were special forces, real special forces, were staging incursions into this village. So the workers that I talked to who had built the village and had to wear the what they called Middle Eastern garb, who were working there, they experienced something close to war, because they would be going about there every day using these bikes for transportation, and their village would be invaded by real American forces who were training for similar scenarios overseas. And there was just so many layers of what was real and what was false in that scenario. I just found it so compelling. One of the workers said, "Hey, listen, you know, a lot of these soldiers, I mean, they're mostly all really young guys, and they love bikes too. They'd see these bikes, they'd pick them up, they'd be popping wheelies on them, and suddenly, as soon as the soldiers left, so did a lot of bicycles." So these bikes were just passing hands in very interesting and compelling ways, and just merging through worlds in the way that another item might not be able to.
Then these bikes would come back into Mexico, sometimes on huge truckloads. And the irony of that as well, that the vehicle that was allowing people to move from one side of the border to the other then was being brought back to be used to have people go over the border illegally, and that they just passed right through at the border. And I found that kind of cycling through of bicycles at this heavily, as you say, it's one of the most enforced borders in our whole country. But yet the vehicle, these bicycles were just coming back in.
You know, when I first encountered the bicycles in the Tijuana River Valley, I might have learned, if I had looked just a little bit closer, one of the great mysteries, and that was, where are they coming from in such numbers? Was there possibly that many ordinary bicycles in Tijuana that were made available to these human smugglers? Was it a trend? I mean, where were these bikes coming from? If I looked closer, I would have seen stickers of origin, stickers of registration from various cities across the country, stickers that said they'd been sold from a certain shop in the United States, stickers that suggested they'd been sold at auction by police departments. And in fact, that's what was happening. The human smugglers, they were coming across and going into cities across the Southwest from Houston to Los Angeles, and they were buying bicycles in bulk from police auctions, pennies on the pound, putting them into U-Haul type trucks and marking them as donations to charities in Mexico and hauling them across the boundary, where they would put a migrant on top. If a migrant couldn't ride a bicycle, they even had a team to teach the migrant to ride. And they were crossing into the United States. Another big mystery for me was, how was this possible in this fortified area? But it turns out that it's a simple equation. Every technology that we can bring to bear on the boundary has a hack. Each one has a weak spot. The laser tripwires and the infrared cameras, they go absolutely blind during our sea fogs, which happens quite often. And the Border Patrol just can't work that area with any kind of efficiency. Well, seismic sensors, we rely on 18,000 seismic sensors that are buried across the boundary. They're responsible for all kinds of stories in the history of the Border Patrol, but they detect thumping things, running things, walking things, earth-shaking things. And traditionally, migrants walked and they ran. Well, the bicycles reversed that trend, and suddenly the migrants rolled, and they were able to pass through this area without being detected.
And it seems that, you know, we've heard so many stories of people even dying crossing over through the desert areas. But the image in my mind of people on bicycles doing what many of us do for pleasure, riding down a hill and with the wind blowing our hair, and that this is how people were leaving Mexico and coming to America. The vision of that somehow is very different from people fleeing in terror and maybe being very frightened, though I'm sure these people were afraid.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when they came up against what some people call the border industrial complex, just the size and scale of the walls and that infrastructure, is definitely intimidating to migrants. But this was the hardest thing I had to jibe in my research, was there's these great books, well-researched books about tragedies happening with migrants in the deserts, migrants being taken advantage of, migrants succumbing to the elements. And the people I talked to who crossed on bike, they'd slap their leg and laugh. Mm-hmm. They thought that was the best part of their crossing. I talked to one guy who, he felt his bicycle, the one he had received across, was so nice that maybe he wouldn't cross. this was the best part of their journeys. Not to say, I mean, bad things happen to these people both after they crossed and before, But this one instance was just so funny to people that it actually, that was the opening into my research. You know, if I had been looking into any other technique, I don't think I would have gotten very far. But the people who crossed and the people who were doing it thought it was so funny that this huge enforcement effort was being defeated by a humble bicycle, they were willing to open up and tell stories.
Let's get back to some of the key players in this movement. And it seems like there was a surge in the bikes being used. And as you say, 7,000 bicycles, which probably represents at least that many people being traversed. Then that changed, and maybe El Indio got out of the game or whatever. So talk a little bit about the legendary Indio, and because this is a very human story about him and maybe even his broken heart. But he seemed like, as you portrayed him, a mysterious person who did have a heart.
Well, every coyote who is the head of these human smuggling operations becomes famous because of their technique or their reliability. There's kind of legends grow about these characters. And when I started my research, that the legends were the first things that I had learned about this coyote. The old school smugglers, they considered the clients their guests, that they had to take care of these clients, because if they passed them successfully and efficiently and they took care of them, then those migrants were going to call their brothers and their cousins and their families and say, hey, I crossed with this certain guy and in this interesting way, and you know, you need to get a hold of him. That was the old school way of operating this business, and El Indio took that on himself, and he cared for his people, and that was one of the first things that I learned about his character. And it may have to do with his own history, because he was a young guy. He grew up in a tiny little village in Oaxaca. Rural Mexico had suffered through economic crises through the 80s and 90s, that just people went to bed without food in their stomachs. Kids, you know, if they got food, it was usually local fruit. Eating meat was a rare treat. So a lot of people, especially in this area, they migrated to find work in the United States. El Indio's two older brothers and two older sisters had done that. And then at one point, El Indio's parents came to him and they said, hey, listen, we're going to migrate. The upshot is we're going to pay for middle school. You can go to middle school, but you have to stay here and be with your elderly grandfather. If we're successful, we'll send for you. If not, we'll return. Well, it turned out that El Indio lost connection with his parents. There's no phones or electricity in his village, so it was easy to do at that point. He went to school, and he graduated middle school. His elderly grandfather died, and he was just left with this decision. Do I stay here and just scrape by, or do I go to the boundary and try and reunite with my family? One aspect of migration that I don't think a lot of people think about is that a lot of these migrants are coming from very rural areas, and they're coming to these cities on the border that are just bubbling and in some ways set up to take advantage of them. El Indio arrived to Tijuana on a bus. He got off the bus, and he just walked along the boundary line from the mountains to the oceans, trying to get a handle on what to do. I mean, he could see, had he known the neighborhood where his parents had lived, he would have seen them from the border highlands. But there was also scrums of deported people just living in the river and haunting the boundary line, just trying to figure out a way to get back across to their jobs and their families. El Indio was the rare migrant, however, who saw the economy in crossing people across that boundary. And rather than an attempt to cross himself and work in the U.S., he joined this economy that was set up to pass people. And the first rung on that ladder is a recruiter. He would find people like himself from rural Mexico that arrived at the bus station or were hanging out along the boundary line or in the river. And he would recruit them, and he would pass them on to a coyote, and the coyote would pay him. And in this way, he learned the business. But at one point, he two things happened. He realized that there was a way to cross this boundary on bicycle. And the other thing that happened is he fell in love with the daughter of Tijuana's most famous or successful coyotes. And those two things kind of united to build his business. The woman he fell in love with helped him scale the business, and the technique just took off like wildfire. And he became quite successful and quite famous. He arrived to the boundary with just pesos in his pocket, no way, no idea of how to cross. And within a few years, he was a millionaire. As I was doing this reporting of the drug war along the boundary, especially in cities like Tijuana, were just red hot. And at one point, El Indio just dropped the business altogether, closed shop, all of his workers just scattered. And it was because of the drug wars that anybody who was making money, especially illegally, was a target, and it was too dangerous. So he just vanished, and that was another mystery that I came upon. Where did he go? I didn't know why he vanished. But even when I found out why, I didn't know where he had gotten to and what happened to his workers.
All of a surprising source and collaborator for you, and did a lot of the information about the particulars of Indio and Indio's life and Marta and the people around Indio come from El Negro.
The man who became my best ally in ferreting out this story, he was a deportee. He had a family in the United States. He'd worked in the United States for 28 years and actually had had legal status at one point, but he was deported for a series of drunk driving issues. And so when I found him, he was just trying to figure out what to do with his life. He was cut off from his family. He was cut off from his traditional income in the country he knew best. And he was working as a bathroom attendant at the bathrooms in Playas de Tijuana. Well, that area during our housing boom was just a circus of smugglers and collaborators, as well as migrants and all the smugglers with all their techniques, from the famous rope ladder guy to the jet ski and the guy who would cross people on ponga boats. They were all in this location, and El Negro, even as he worked his humble job, got to know all of these people. So he was a fantastic source, but it turned out more than that. He was, even though his educated only went as far as middle school, he just was a fantastic researcher and someone who was able to go into slums in Tijuana and find the right people who knew various parts of this story that we were trying to put together.
And that seemed to surprise him as well, that at that point in his life that, oh, he's a journalist too.
Oh, yeah. As I mentioned, he was just kind of bereft. I mean, he was severed from his family and means to make money. He'd made some bad decisions that turned his life upside down, and there was no reversing it. And here he was working at the bathrooms at 50 years old, folding pieces of toilet paper to pass to the people who used the bathrooms for 5 pesos each. But when he began this work, his investigative work, he realized how good he was at it. And he actually told me, you know, at one point, I questioned why I learned I had this skill this late in my life. But then I realized that it actually came just in time.
Kimball Taylor, thanks for spending time with us. This is an incredible book, and I think our listeners will be able to see that there's a lot of different tendrils. Just as the bicycles traverse a lot of different places, so does this book and colorful stories throughout. And thanks so much for this incredible book and for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
Bye now.
My conversation with Kimball Taylor on his book, The Coyote's Bicycle, The Untold Story of 7,000 Bicycles and the Rise of a Borderland Empire. I'm Suzanne Lang, and you're listening to A Novel Idea. Let's take a short break before talking with Emma Bland Smith on her book, Journey, based on the true story of OR7, the most famous wolf in the West.
Yo sé que los mil besos que te he dado en la boca se me fue el corazón. Si dicen que es pecado, que eres como te quiero. Quizás de gran razón, pero quiero importarme de todo lo que digan si no te me olvidan. Si es pecado amarte, yo seguiré pecando porque lo he de negar.
The gray wolf is a native species that was extirpated from California by humans by the 1920s and through most of its range in the United States by the mid-1930s. Over time, and with the assistance of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the gray wolf has been expanding its population through Montana, Wyoming, and the Pacific Northwest. In 2011, a young gray wolf, designated as OR7, left its pack in northeastern Oregon and, after traveling hundreds and hundreds of miles, entered California. Based on these facts, Emma Bland Smith has created a beautiful picture book that imagines the wolf's experiences in close detail as he makes an epic 2,000-mile trek over 3 years' time. The wolf's story is interwoven with the perspective of a young girl who follows his trek through the media. Smith is a writer and librarian, living and working in San Francisco, and here is my conversation with her. Emma Bland Smith, you're here. Welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you.
And we're here to talk about your book, Journey. It's based on the true story of OR7, the most famous wolf in the West. And wolves, they're kind of a hot topic these days. And we can talk about wolves, but let's first talk about what drove you to write this book. And this book is geared towards young people, and it has some beautiful illustrations, and I'd like to talk about those in a minute as well. But what inspired you to write this book?
I've been writing children's books for about 8 years. And so I'm always looking out for things that I see happening around me in the media or in the world that would make a good children's book. I've always been more of a fiction author, really completely a fiction author, actually. But a couple years ago, about 2.5 to 3 years ago, I started seeing newspaper reports about this wolf, OR7, who had crossed the border from Oregon into California, becoming the first wolf in California in almost 100 years. And I just kind of stored the idea away. I thought, I wonder if that could make a children's book. And I started doing a little more research. And I was also inspired by a very famous children's book in California called Humphrey the Lost Whale, which was based on a lot of people will remember Humphrey the humpback whale who went up the Sacramento River in 1985. Someone wrote a children's book about that, and it's still in print today, which is really amazing. Very long print run for a children's book. And so I thought, oh, that's an example of someone writing a story about a live animal and something that really happened. But I felt like the story, I needed a little bit more. And so I started researching it, and I learned that there had been a naming contest where a conservation group had asked children to send in names for the wolf. They were trying to publicize it so that the wolf would be safe. And I thought, oh, well, that would be great because children can relate more to books in which there is a child character. And then it came out in the media that the wolf, OR7, had found another wolf and settled down and had pups. And that really made for a lovely ending and gave the story some closure, even though it's actually just the beginning of a whole story. So that's when I decided, oh, I think this could make a great, great children's book.
Tell me and tell our listeners, though, I enjoyed reading it and looking at the pictures. What age group are you really targeting with this book?
That's a really good question, because picture books can be meant for kids as young as 2 and as old as 8 or even older. This is definitely a picture book for the slightly older group of kids, which is a trend among picture books. And I think it's really great because people often forget about the older kids, the 3rd graders and the 4th graders, who still really enjoy reading picture books with their parents or with their classes and seeing the melding of great art and writing. And people kind of tend to forget that at that age, they just let kids read chapter books. But this book it's fairly long for a picture book, quite long for a picture book, and has a lot of scientific information, a lot of nonfiction facts. And so even though I've been reading it to kids a lot lately, and kids as young as 4 have been very engaged and they love the pictures of the wolves and can listen no problem, the older kids really get a lot out of it. So I would say that the age range is from about 4 to 9 or 10.
And the illustrations are absolutely lovely. I mean, they're realistic and they don't pander or anthropomorphize the animals, and they highlight the not only the journey of the wolf, but the journey of the little girl as well. So who did the illustrations? Tell us about Robin James and how you hooked up with the illustrator.
Thank you for saying that. I'm also really happy with the illustrations. They were done by a woman named Robin James, and she is an illustrator who lives near Seattle. And one interesting thing about the children's book writing world that I've learned is that authors generally don't get to pick their illustrator, which was fine with me. I'm just the author, and I wanted to leave it up to the publisher to do what they know how to do best. So they chose this illustrator, Robin James, because she had done a book called Alaska's Dog Heroes, which was beautiful. And so they knew that she was very good at drawing and painting dogs and would do a great job with wolves. So I was thrilled, and she did do a wonderful job.
Yeah, it's a really lovely, lovely book. And wolves are in the news right now, and, well, I don't want to give too much of the story away, but OR7, the first wolf that journeyed down into California and mated and had pups, I think he's back up in Oregon now, but there is a Shasta pack in California, in Northern California now, and I wonder how you talk to your when you're visiting with young people about this book, because wolves in California and indeed bringing wolves back from extinction in the lower 48 states is a success story, but not without peril. And there are many people who maybe are holding on to those prejudices of ranching life over 100 years ago. And yeah, Ranchers are not happy. And we have so much ranching on public lands, and public lands are the prime habitat for wolves. So how do you talk to children about all this?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It actually goes back to 1995 when biologists decided to reintroduce the gray wolf into America, where it was basically extinct. And they released 66 wolves into Yellowstone and the surrounding areas, wolves that they had brought from Canada. And this repopulation attempt was very successful, and the wolves began to spread. And then in about 2008, a couple of wolves swam over the river. It makes such a great story. They swam the Snake River from Idaho into Oregon, and that's when they began to repopulate Oregon, northeastern Oregon. And then a couple of years later, OR7 was the trailblazer who went south from northeastern Oregon into California and did begin to repopulate southern Oregon and northern California. And as you said, there has since been discovered another pack that that scientists have called the Shasta Pack in northern California. So it is very controversial. Wolves are not dangerous to people, but if they are sharing space with ranchers and if they don't have enough to hunt because their natural prey have been eradicated, they have been known to come after ranchers' animals, although it's very rare. And so when I talk to kids about this, I'll be honest about it. But what I really want to impress upon them is the fact that wolves are really not meant to be living side by side with people. They can't be domesticated. They're not like coyotes. They aren't adaptable to cities and to suburbs. And what we really need to do is to set aside and preserve big pieces of land where they can live on their own without people coming in, where there are no roads and no farms. So I really want this to be an environmental story and make kids think about not just wolves, but nature and protecting land and habitat.
The wolves have become extinct because they were killed by humans. And that act in the early part of the 1900s really did then disrupt a lot of the ecosystem balance in areas that they had lived. For instance, when you get rid of wolves, then maybe there's more coyotes and the elk don't behave the way they usually behave because they're not being predated by wolves. And so the entire ecosystem becomes out of balance in a way. So and that they're just coming back, it seems like it might take some time and space to have that balance reachieved. And public we have so many public lands in the West, it seems like it shouldn't be this controversial.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know as much about that issue, but because I've been studying wolves in California. But there is a lot of research that shows that when the wolves were brought back to Yellowstone, they began to hunt the elk, which had not been hunted for many years. And this was not even the intent when they were brought back. But over the years, the whole ecosystem in Yellowstone has improved with the numbers of elk decreasing and the trees growing by the rivers that the elk had decimated, and that bringing back water, mammals like beavers, and a whole ecosystem that's been improved. So I do think that wolves were the missing link there. And it's great that they are back in Oregon. And there are studies that show that there is a lot more space for wolves, even with humans, than we realize, and that California and Oregon can support a lot more wolves than they have right now.
I think it's all very exciting to, you know, they're high up on the food chain. And so there is this cascading effect of even birds that feed off of the carcass of elk that have been killed by wolves. And so it's just this whole pattern that has been missing for a long time, really. And I think that children are people who need to know the real story. And it's a hard story to tell.
Yeah, it is hard. It's hard to talk about the wolves being killed, being hunted almost to extinction. And when I talk about that in school visits, I do have to be careful. I don't want to scare the youngest kids, but I also think it's very important for them to know that, and to know what our country has done to animals and to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And so I really do want to impress upon them the tragedy of it. Another thing that to my surprise, a lot of kids have shown concern over is the tracking collar that OR7 the Wolf and many wolves wear. And to me, this always just seemed not very important and just matter of fact. But the kids are fascinated by the collar and they want to know, does it hurt? How do they get the collar on the wolves? Then I have to talk about tranquilizing the wolf, and that can be upsetting for the littlest of kids. And they often ask me, what happens to the collar? What happens to the collar after the batteries run out? And that's, strangely enough, something I hadn't thought a whole lot about. I do think that in some cases, when the batteries run out, the biologist will go in and remove the collar. But OR7 is actually still wearing his collar, even though the batteries are not working. They're not tracking him. But I think that they have considered going in and replacing the batteries, but they haven't done that yet.
Well, children will ask those kind of questions. And I think California in particular has an interesting history with wildlife, you know, with the Farallon Islands and Tule elk that were hunted to near extinction. And I think time and again, we have seen when these animals are given space, they can still thrive. And so it's good work you're doing. And tell me about how you chose kind of the arc of the story and to tell it with a human character and how you let the wolf be the wolf.
Sure, absolutely. When I decided to write this story, as I said before, I am generally more comfortable with writing fiction. But there is a new kind of nonfiction that writers are attempting with, particularly with kids, and it's often called narrative nonfiction or creative nonfiction. And this isn't exactly that, because this is not pure nonfiction. But I did want to write a true story with more of fiction techniques, which means with a narrative arc and with tension and with more lyrical language that is sometimes used than in straight nonfiction. So as far as the alternating, the book, I alternate between the wolf's point of view and the girl's point of view. And as I said before, I thought that it would be more engaging to kids to have a child character in the book. And so I wanted to have that. And I wanted to really get inside the wolf's mind. But we had to be very careful to do that without putting human emotions on him, as you mentioned before. And so there were times that was tricky, when I wanted to say something like, the wolf was scared. And my editor would write back to me and say, well, let's not go there. We can't say the wolf was scared. We have to show that he's scared in another way by showing his body language. And so that was a challenge, but it was a really fun challenge to really show by what he was doing and the way he was acting how he was scared, or how he was torn. In a lot of the scenes in the book, the wolf is torn between his instincts to go back to his homeland where he was born and the instinct to keep going, to keep pushing onward south and west into California. And that must have been a hard decision every time he made it, because he was going where wolves had not been for close to 100 years. And there were no wolves there. As far as biologists knew, he was probably traveling in hopes of finding a mate, but they didn't think he would find a mate because there were no other wolves there at all. And it really felt like something of a miracle when it turned out that another wolf had made that very same trek, and they did end up meeting up. So I really enjoyed the back and forth with the wolf pushing on and then the girl following him by using the media. So in different scenes, I have her reading about the wolf in the newspaper, hearing about him on the radio, reading the internet, and then tracking him on her own wall on a map with thumbtacks. And then she is actually able to do something proactive to help protect the wolf, which is really exciting and also a message to kids that they can make a difference and make a change in this world.
Yes, and participate. And that it is what is kind of fascinating about all that. And then now you have a book, a hardcover book, where you turn the pages, and it somehow, to me, is that it's not digital media, is I don't know, there's something rich about that, that our children are so exposed to digital media, as is this young girl in the book. But the actions go beyond that and affect change. And your book is something to hold in one's hand and to savor and not be irradiated while looking at it. So
thank you.
So, and there was one other thing that I had thought about with the wolf and his, you know, I guess I wonder about the tracking of not only wolves, but other wildlife species that we only know about the ones that are collared, that are under surveillance, so to speak. And so there's something to me hopeful that there may be others out there as well that are literally under the radar.
That's right. And that's another thing that is controversial, collaring of wolves in general, because it does really seem like an invasion of their lives to do that. And I know that biologists certainly don't want to collar all wolves, but it is incredibly helpful for them to do that with some so that they can learn where wolves are traveling and more about wolf behavior. But lots of the wolves, for instance, the Shasta pack that was discovered in California, none of those wolves are collared. They don't have a name. They're not known by biologists at all. They are completely on their own. And those wolves, and the majority of wolves are not collared. And those wolves, the only way that biologists will know that they exist sometimes is by catching them, catching their photo, taking their picture on motion sensor cameras. And in fact, all of the pictures that we have of OR7 are, we don't have very many, and they're all taken by these motion sensor cameras that are strapped to trees and just left there, and the wolves aren't even aware of them. And they can be very, very, very useful too, just with a minimum of invasion of privacy, just letting us know a little bit more about animals. But I agree that there's something really beautiful and wonderful about the idea of just letting them be on their own. We might not see them, but we know that they're out there.
Journey, based on the true story of OR7, the most famous wolf in the West. Emma Bland-Smith is the author, with illustrations by Robin James. Thanks for coming in today. And I know you are going to be speaking at some schools around the county. What are some of the other oddball things kids say to you when you're visiting them in their classrooms?
They always ask me if he's alive or dead. And I realize that that's something that I forgot to say. And they will always tell me stories about seeing wolves in their backyards and how they saw a wolf, especially the young kids, how they saw a wolf last week and a wolf crept into their house. And it's just wonderful to witness their imaginations.
And has maybe this book and the research you've done brought you back to Jack London at all?
Yes.
I felt like I wanted to go read Call of the Wild again.
Definitely. I read those books when I was young and I loved them. And I've been to Jack London State Park recently, and I definitely want to reread those with this in mind.
Yes. Emma, thanks for coming and visiting us.
Thank you for having me.
Emma Bland-Smith and I talking about her book, Journey, based on the true story of OR7, the most famous wolf in the West. Earlier in the broadcast, we heard from Kimball Taylor on his book, The Coyote's Bicycle, the untold story of 7,000 bicycles and the rise of a borderland empire. We have had production assistance today from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast at krcb.org and listen to us anytime. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thank you so much for listening. It's a novel idea.